The following is a Japan Society lecture program audio podcast. For more information about Japan Society's programs, please visit www.japansociety.org.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Japan Society. I'm Dick Wood, the president of Japan Society, and it's a pleasure to welcome John Nathan back to Japan Society. I was just chatting with John. I remember when he brought Full Moon Lunch to Earlham College a few years ago, like when it came out. And it and the things he's done since are very important work. I remember actually teaching with Jackson Bailey in a course where we used Farm Song, for example. So it's a real pleasure to welcome John back. It's not my job to introduce him, though. It's my job to remind you to turn off your cell phones, whoops, which I have not done. And then to also mention a couple of upcoming lecture programs that we will have this spring. The first is on May 5th, and we're going to have another program in the Authors on Asia series, this one, Ann Allison talking about millennial monsters, Japanese toys, and the global imagination. And then on May 27th, the Satyagraha Forum Reflections on Citizens' Movements, Peace and Politics in the U.S. and Japan with Tom Hayden and James Orr. Both of those promise to be extremely interesting programs. I'll repeat those. May 27th for the peace and politics, and May 5th for Japanese monster toys. And now it's my pleasure to welcome back another good friend of Japan Society, Tom Hare, who is professor at Princeton University, has a formidable title that is William Sutter Laporte Professor in Regional Studies and Professor of Comparative Literature. I used to be head of an organization that you couldn't say the whole name of in one phrase. Tom is currently writing a book on performance in Muromachi culture while translating Zayami's writings on no drama. He is one of the best scholars dealing with these things around, and we are honored and pleased to have him back to moderate tonight's program. Tom?
Thank you, Dick. That was very kind. It is a pleasure. I can't even really tell you what a pleasure it is to be here to introduce John Nathan. We go back. I was an undergraduate at Princeton when John was still a professor there. And I'll never forget the Thursday afternoon that I walked into his seminar on Edo fiction, and we sat around the table in front of Saikaku, and somebody brought out a bottle of cognac, which seemed to go very well with Saikaku, I must say. It's truly a pleasure. I'm sure almost all of you know John Nathan and certainly know about him, but I will run through some of his many accomplishments here just as a reminder. Of course, tonight we're going to be hearing about Living Carelessly in Tokyo and Elsewhere, a memoir. But John has a number of other books, Japan Unbound from 2003, translations of Oe Kenzaburo, among others, a very important book about Sony from inside, from the private lives of Morita and others who ran this wonderful, amazing company. The first book of John's that I read was actually, apart from translations, was his book Mishima, a biography, which followed fairly quickly on the demise of the celebrated Japanese author. But I think of all the things I know of John's, that the things that are really my very favorites are his films. he won an Emmy in 1982 for The Colonel Goes to Japan. But even before that, in 1979, he made a series of three wonderful films, a trilogy of Full Moon Lunch, The Blind Swordsman, and Farm Song, which are at once ethnologies, films of art, superb documents about contemporary Japan, in the 70s. Last time I saw John, I was disturbed to learn that these films are not readily available at all. In fact, some of them might not be available at all anymore. I hope that that situation has been remedied somewhat. It looks like it has been. I don't think that I will waste our time when John Nathan is sitting in the audience and ready to tell us things. So without more ado, then, I will introduce John Nathan.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I've been here many times over the past, always in connection with something that I've done or tried to do, and I have a lot of feelings about this place and a lot of feelings about many of you and a lot of feelings about this rather headlong, as it feels to me, evening we're about to get into. When I came back, like Rip Van Winkle, to the university about 14 years ago after a long hiatus in which I pretended that I was a Hollywood sort of fellow and a lot of other things, I presented myself vulnerably to a group of academicians who I hadn't seen in a long time, began talking. One of them raised his hand and said to me, "How do you problematize that?" And I thought, oh my goodness, how do you problematize anything? And of course I learned over time that meant dressing something up in some kind of somber suit to make it seem in some way significant and so on. So when I was asked to come here, Dick or someone said, well, you know, we don't want just a reading. We'd like some kind of a lecture, and I'm going to Harvard tomorrow, where, of course, they expect something problematized. So I thought, how do I do that in this chronicle that I've just written about my life and so on? It's a little embarrassing, of course, too, because this is a memoir, which means I have to speak about myself, something that my family knows I'm loathe to do. Stand up. My wife is telling me to stand up. Okay, I'll be happy to stand up. I think I should come over here, actually. Good idea. Thank you. In the way of problematization, I thought that I would do a reading, but dress it up a little bit. I'm going to talk tonight briefly about the idea of persona, which is really very important when you start talking about memoirs, for example. What is a persona? Well, a persona is the character that is created, and I use the word emphatically, in the narrative that unfurls in the course of this book between the front and the back covers. Part of the persona, of course, may be more or less unconscious. Other parts in a literary memoir, which I dare say you will allow me to call this, or hope you will, is quite conscious. I mean, one does decide as one goes along what is going to be revealed, what is going to be told, what is going to be withheld, what sort of emphases are going to be placed on stories that just occur in the chaos of reality as it unfurls in your life. So there is a persona which emerges, and I think as I try to put this at arm's length a little bit and look at it as just a book as opposed to something that I did, which is the only way to avoid acute embarrassment this evening, for example, but also may be useful, I begin to see that there is a persona in here which has been created by me, in this case, since I'm the author. And I'd like to sort of just get into that a little bit with you and see where it takes us. Let me begin with a brief episode, which I thought would be very hard indeed to problematize when I looked at it. But then I thought, you know, actually, I could probably make some book on this if I worked at it hard enough. Let me see if I can find the notes, which I often lose on the way to the lecture. No, that's not it. Oh, well, I'll just do this and we'll see what happens. Here's an episode which I wrote about the first holiday season in my first year at Japan when I had just arrived, when I was a young man, 21 years old. Japan, I'm quoting now, Japan closes for a week to celebrate the new year. I spent 2 days in Zushi with Kenji's family visiting temples in the hills of Kamakura and was invited for dinner at Viola's home in Ogikubo. I should explain that each of these characters has the name of a character in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night because I was directing these girls in an all-English production, so I'm calling them by their stage names, these dramatis personae. On the way, I stopped at the Toyoko department store in Shibuya to buy a New Year's gift for the family. The food hall in the basement was dressed like a Christmas tree with the New Year's gift baskets, the Japanese call osebo. The most extravagant assortments combine Japanese delicacies, fine rice crackers, tea cakes, slices of Kobe beef marinated in miso, and Western luxury items, cans of Libby's fruit cocktail, and bottles of Johnny Walker Black. I chose a whole smoked salmon with a head attached. That's a fancy thing to do, is to bring a fish with its head attached to someone. And when I presented it to Viola's mother, she seemed pleased. While she worked in the kitchen, Viola and I and her teenage sister and brother and Sir Toby, who had also been invited, played Baba Nuki, old maid. Dinner was broiled fish and steamed vegetables and rice. Viola's father staggered in after nine, home from an end-of-the-year party with his colleagues at the office. I wondered if this was awkward, but no one seemed uncomfortable. The man in the house in a Japanese family has rights. He greeted me in English. "I'm in the neck of time." Paused to tug at the zipper of his fly, which he had noticed was unzipped, and switched into formal Japanese, too slurred for me to fully understand. I heard, "Have you ever seen such a home as this?" and replied, thinking a compliment was in order, "No, sir, this is my first time." Stunned silence followed by hilarity. Viola explained, when she could catch her breath, that her father had offered a modest self-disparagement. "Have you ever seen such a cramped and squalid home as this?" To which the prescribed response was, "On the contrary." I was invited back the next day for a formal midday New Year's meal. This time, the extended family was there, grandparents, aunts and uncles, and cousins. Bowls and nested lacquer trays of traditional New Year's food were arrayed on low tables installed end-to-end on the tatami mat floor in the main room. As I took my place near the center of the table, accepting an invitation to sit with my legs in front instead of under me, I felt a familiar quiver in my bowels. My father's legacy to me was a spastic colon. In the house of my childhood, bottles of Kaopectate were concealed in every drawer like alcoholic's gin. Feeling trapped at that formal New Year's table triggered my affliction. I had to ask for the nearest bathroom. Viola's brother pointed at a paper door at the rear of the room, and when I had clambered up from the table and crossed the room to slide it open, I saw that the toilet, though plumbed and porcelain, was nonetheless a squatter. I have memories of squat toilets across Japan, nightmarish in winter, particularly when I was obliged to remove and place out of harm's way in the confines of a cabinet not only my trousers but a bulky overcoat. I say obliged because I was never limber enough, even as a young man, to assume with any poise the position Asians, and I suppose sharecroppers, master in their infancy. I slid the door closed and confirmed that the chatter at the festive table just a few feet away was clearly audible. I undressed and straddled the bowl. A metal bracket like a towel rack was screwed to the wall in front of me near the floor. As I hunkered down, I grasped the bracket with both hands to steady myself and, losing my balance and sitting heavily back, yanked the fixture from the wall with a splintering crack. The table next door went silent. I sat on the toilet bowl, the bracket in my hands, and watched the plaster spill from the two holes I had opened in the wall. I prayed for transport back to my home in Tucson, or if that was unreasonable, to be flushed down the toilet. Aware that the family was still sitting in silence, I stuck the bracket into the wall, sagging on its bent screws, and returned to the table. I have never felt so embarrassed before or since. The party resumed as if nothing had happened. Okay, so, you know, I've chosen this, obviously, being something of an entertainer because I knew it would amuse you, but more importantly, in the context of tonight, what is this about? I mean, will Nathan do anything for a laugh? Is that what this person, is this guy someone who's a sort of clown who, you know, I abase myself, I put myself in this very compromised situation. Part of that is true. I mean, there is about this book a certain amount of rue and ruefulness and apology and regret and so on. So right away with something like this, I'm obviously establishing myself as a person who is certainly not above ridicule, certainly, and then that ridicule can lead to other things, which it does. So there is a way to sort of look at this and to make something out of it more than just bathroom humor, so to speak. Let me give you another example of something that leads on or proceeds onwardly from this. This is when I was translating The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea with Yukio Mishima, so I'm a little older, maybe 2 years older, not much more. I was giddy with self-importance to be hanging out with Mishima as though we were friends. I was also uneasily aware that he was counting on me to deliver the goods. Unfailingly, when I thanked him for his solicitous at the end of an evening, he waved aside my deference and assured me I would more than repay him with a splendid translation. I laid out $200 for a Mont Blanc fountain pen, the stubby cigar model used by every considerable Japanese novelist. My half share of the Knopf advance was $400, and completed each chapter by hand in a thick notebook before I typed it on my Olivetti. Excuse me. Working at night until dawn, as Mishima did, alone in the hushed house with my manuscript, I reveled in the feeling that I was a literary man, a real writer, an artist in my own right. Or was I? What if the translation exposed me as an imposter? The thought filled me with dread. Was I great or a nobody? At the time, I failed to recognize the narcissist's dilemma. So here already, by this was on page 65, obviously the reader's thinking, wow, this guy's got some problem. You know, he's not that easy with himself. Is he a narcissist? Is he a clown? Is he any good? Is he fantastic? Is he grandiose? What is he? So I'm actually creating a persona which is quite vulnerable and exposed, and I think that's definitely part of this book, and obviously has something to do with the fact that I was so thrilled when I came upon the title, Living Carelessly, you know, in Tokyo. And I don't want to do a mea culpa thing and break down in tears in front of you, I guarantee you. I'm just trying to problematize my memoir. let me give you another example, and then I'll get off this and get to something else. Here I am much later, returning to Japan with my family after a lapse of about 7 or 8 years, when I actually turned away from Japan for a while because I felt that it was too, I had to prove myself on home ground, meaning the United States. In Japan, for the first time in 4 years, I made no attempt to contact any of the people who had been so important to me in the past. To be sure, I was working on or on the move most of the time, but a busy schedule shouldn't have stopped me from reaching out to friends so close and dear in the past. Oe and Kobo Abe, for example, who were both in Tokyo that spring. Truth was, I had already let important connections unravel through inattention, and that predilection for carelessness has been a bane to me all my life. So you can see that this begins to accrete as we go through the book. I hope not too heavily-handedly, but nonetheless it's there in the nature of a coloration, a tonality, a, if you permit, persona. Now, the creation of persona involves a certain amount of invention. You know, there's a wonderful story by Bernard Malamud. I don't know if you're familiar with it, where a young, eager graduate student, novelist wannabe, is getting in Malamud's way. You know, and he starts writing this stuff, and Malamud becomes very annoyed at this guy, and he says, "Invent," because he's doing a sort of a biographical sketch. And Malamud looks at this and says, "You're trapped basically in faction." You know, more. So he says, invent. So, in fact, there is invention in a persona, it turns out. It also turns out that the reading public is very uneasy about this. Readers don't like to think that persona is being created. And that means that there's, in fact, inherently a kind of tension between the reader and the writer, in the case that the writer is doing, for example, a literary memoir and attempting to create a persona. There's all kinds of evidence for this. You guys have recently read the story of the young woman who lived this lie and represented that she was a foster child who'd been raised in Los Angeles and drugs and gangs. This goes all the way back to people like Clifford Irving, you know, who, of course, is a great scam and con man who represented. You remember that he was writing the biography of Howard Hughes, which turned out to be all false. Interestingly, hi Mark, I didn't see you. Released recently, this book, which had made so much trouble, and I'm not apologizing for Irving, who was a real, who was a criminal, was released as a novel. The same thing. It's Howard Hughes, A Life, is okay if you tell everybody that it's a novel, but was not okay when it was represented to be a biography, which it isn't. So readers get very upset about this, and I have a great example of this in my own book, which I want to share with you. It's a little bit sort of telling tales about on myself, or I'm not sure how you characterize it, but it's just great. On page 2 of this book, you know, I'm asked, I don't mean the writing is just great, see, I'm disparaging myself, I mean these examples, just great. You know, everybody wants to know always about someone, you know, why do you well, why Japan? You know, and I start out, and people look at me and they say, well, he's a big oaf, and his hands are like hams, and so why would a guy like that be interested in this kind of beautiful, delicate, you know, nuanced stuff that you see all around you in our beautiful Japan society surroundings? So then I tell this story about how I was uneasy at Harvard and I wanted something that was exotic and so on. And then one day, 2 or 3 weeks into my first year, a Japanese student sits down next to me in the dining room and he, I'll read this. At lunch in the freshman union, a student from Japan drew for me on a napkin a two-character compound and explained that it meant an infection that occurs between the nails of beneath the nails of the toes and fingers. Parenthesis. Later, I learned that the English word is whitlow, a word that many of you may not have used that regularly in the course of your lives, but it is there. I stared at the abstract characters, astonished that they could signify so precisely. That week, I sat in on a class in modern Japanese literature, and so on and so forth. But I begin with this thing. Now, there's a piece of this which was removed from the book. My magnificent editor is here tonight, somewhere, Amber Qureshi, isn't she? I love her, and she's great, and we did a great meet, and we had this very interesting conversation early on in the editing process. Amber said, well, I'll read you what was in this, what followed what I just read to you. After I wrote about the characters, and I said, I stared at the abstract crowd, astonished they could signify so precisely, and then I say that really got me hooked on Japanese. And then I went on to write, that's how I remember it. I can picture the word, hyoso. And I have told the story many times over the years. But as I write it down for the first time, I wonder why a student would have chosen such an unlikely term to show me. Is this an imagined memory, part of a fictional history I have invented to transform my past into an entertaining tale? Now, Amber came back, you know, and she said, no. And I said, Amber, why? I want this. And she said, because you're planting a seed of doubt in the reader's mind on page 3, and that's not a cool thing to do. You know, you're going to make people think that you're a, you know. So I, of course, had the good judgment and the good sense to defer to her, which is why the book is, if it's good, that's one of the major reasons that it is, because she did a great job. But it's interesting thematically in the context of this, which is to say that she was saying that the reader doesn't want to hear about the fact that persona is being created. Now, did this really happen to me? I'm not going to tell you. I think it did. You know, I kind of remember it happening on some level, but persona is, in fact, created. And just to go one step further in this part of the story, there's something else which I took out of the book. You know, it's broken into two parts. And part one takes me through sort of my first engagement with Japan, and then I get angry, and Saul Bellow calls me a squaw man, and a bunch of other things that make me very uncomfortable happen. You don't know what a squaw man, I'll tell you in a minute. And I sort of leave Japan, and then part two is what happens after that, and moving down toward the present in the last 25 years. And I must say that as I was working on this part of the book and having a great deal of trouble with it, I happened on a quote from Thomas Mann. I was reading The Magic Mountain. And in his preface to The Magic Mountain, Thomas Mann had this to say, stories as histories must be passed. And the further past, one might say, the better for them as stories and for the storyteller, that conjurer who murmurs in past tenses. And I looked at this and I thought, what does this mean to me? And then I wrote the following note, which has disappeared now from the text a long time ago. I wrote, my chronicle to here was compliant enough. That is to say, part one. Allowing me to set it down, not without pain, but with a minimum of unruliness. The pages that follow, the ensuing years, have resisted me, and I think I understand why. With my departure from Japan, an absence that lasted 14 years until I returned to university life at the age of 54, I had run out of a mythology about myself. I had told the story to that point again and again, embellishing it with each retelling until it acquired mythic scale and resonance, but I had confabulated no myth to support the burden of what followed. And in the absence of redeeming myth, the past is as punishing as the intractable present. If I am to avoid the unpleasantness of an unvarnished account of what has happened that merges with contemporary reality, I must conjure a new mythology like a raiment in which to robe presentably, if not to redeem, the 25 years that have intervened between then and now. So I was very aware, and I was actually on to this notion of creating persona and how, you know, if you're just setting something down in a literary memoir and you allow fact and contemporaneous reality to impinge on that process, you can find yourself trapped in a very unhappy place. And I think that the reader would then find him or herself also trapped in an unhappy place, because you would sense that there was a friction here somehow. That's at least my feeling. So I don't know if that's clear or if it makes any sense at all. It makes some sense to me. I hope it makes some sense to you. The point is that there is stuff being created in here, whether we say so or not. And if you read literary memoirs, you will always find, if you look carefully, usually early on, some kind of signal that the author is giving you about the way in which he or she chooses to both represent himself or herself and to be perceived. You try it and you'll see. Recently, because my son was working on a journalism project, we had occasion to look at the autobiography of Lincoln Steffens, for example, this great muckraker, as you remember, in the early 20th century. And the opening paragraph of Steffens' book says, you know, my life has been nothing but happiness, one day after another, happier than the next, until the present, which is happiest of all. And I thought, whoa, I mean, that's there's an example of a persona statement. You know, I mean, Lincoln Steffens was a mess, you know, and had all kinds, but he was letting us know, and that's maintained throughout the book. So, with that said, how are we doing for time? What is the time? It's 7 o'clock. Want to do some time? In that case, I'm going to assume that I have sufficiently problematized to have earned the right to do some reading. And I may not be able to make quite the same case for these passages that come up as I have for the ones that precede, but I think you might enjoy some, just to give you an idea, and I'll comment about each. Let me... actually, before I do that, just to wrap this... No, I think I'll save that for my peroration, so to speak. here's a section on getting into the University of Tokyo, which was very interesting to me, certainly, and may be interesting to you. So, basically, Todai, as you know, has a program called Gakushi Nyugaku, which means entering college as a junior. It's a wonderful thing, because in this country, you know, if you major in civil engineering and decide subsequently that you want to be an English graduate student, it's very hard to get into graduate school with a civil engineering background. The University of Tokyo has a program where you reapply for admission as a junior in any major you want, regardless of what your college focus was, and you have up to 4 years to complete a second BA. It's quite wonderful, actually. I don't know if we have that anywhere in this country. In any event, the entrance exam is not the fearsome thing that results in suicide and all kinds of horrible things that created what was called entrance exam hell. But nonetheless, it's difficult enough, and for me, obviously, it was plenty hard. And so I worked hard on it, and this is just a little passage about taking this exam and what happened. The exam was administered in February in a large, dimly lit room in an ancient building on the Hongo campus. The English and French were not difficult for me. I had to do two foreign languages. And I had carefully studied most of the passages from the classical literature that I was asked to explicate. As for the dreaded essay, you had to do an essay, which was a real killer. You know, they give you these empty paper and they say, write something. You have to practice all the kanji, and it's hard, you know. As for the dreaded essay, I remember only switching to automatic pilot and writing furiously, filling more than 10 pages of manuscript paper provided for the purpose. The following week, I was called back to the campus for the oral exam. When I got to the Department of National Literature, a graduate student ushered me to a cramped office at the rear of the stacks where four professors awaited me. I had met only one of them, Professor Shimamura, to whom I had spoken originally about becoming a regular student at the university. He welcomed me and introduced me to his colleagues, Gomi-sensei, ancient poetry and prose, Maruyama-sensei, Heian literature, and Matsumura-sensei, Japanese linguistics. We chatted briefly about the difficulty of the Japanese language, how hard it was even for Japanese students to comprehend the national literature. the goal I had chosen for myself. I was nervous, but things were going along smoothly enough until suddenly Professor Maruyama looked me in the eye and asked what I thought of Impressionist painting. "I liked it," I replied, a little put off by the abruptness of the question. "In that case," he said, "why not name a few of the French Impressionists?" I had no idea where this was heading, but I was very uncomfortable now and beginning to panic. I sat there in silence, drawing a blank. "Monet," he suggested helpfully. I nodded, racing through my memory in search of names and coming up with none. "Manet, Pissarro, Cézanne, can you name any others?" he asked, watching me closely. I tried for a smile and confessed I was somewhat nervous. "Strange," he said, "because in that essay of yours," he pointed to a manuscript on the desk that I now recognized as my essay, "you refer to Impressionism and the French Impressionists 8 times in 11 pages. I had no idea then or now what my essay was about or why I alluded to Impressionism. The simple explanation may have been that I used the term, worked it in, because I knew how to write it in Chinese characters and thought it would impress my examiners. I was mortified. I felt my face burning as I tried hard to resign myself to having failed my oral exam. Just then, Gomi-sensei spoke. I can hear his words now. In any event, he speaks amazing Japanese, maybe even better than Ambassador Reischauer. I wouldn't go that far, Shimamura demurred. The ambassador speaks like a native. As I listened in disbelief, a debate began, and mercifully, my presence in the room seemed to be forgotten. Presently, Shimamura turned to me and nodded, motioning toward the door. The interview was over, and I was free to leave. Did this really happen? I think so. You see? Admissions were announced in early March. On the appointed morning, I arrived at the campus at 6:30 with a thermos of coffee and joined a crowd of applicants and their families in a small courtyard behind the law building. It was cold, drizzling, not quite light. I looked around. Some people had suitcases with them. They had come straight from the train station or were planning to return home as soon as they heard the news. They waited quietly in their rain gear, but there was terrific tension in the air. For many of these students, the announcement that morning was the culmination of years of preparation. The stakes were high. Admission was tantamount to a first-class ticket to a successful career that could not be purchased elsewhere. For those of you who don't know, the University of Tokyo was, and to a great extent still is, the sort of one place that can bestow on the student a kind of guaranteed first-class ticket into certain kinds of elite jobs like working at the finance ministry and so on. At precisely 7 a.m., an official appeared with a stepladder and a rolled scroll of rice paper. Without a word of welcome or explanation, he stepped to the top of the ladder and began to unroll and tape the paper scroll across the wall of the building, just above his head. As the scroll slowly unfurled, it revealed the examination numbers of students who had gained admission in order, beginning with number 1. As new numbers appeared, shouts of joy burst from the fortunate families in the crowd. Those whose numbers had been skipped stood dejectedly in silence or turned and walked away. Because he had to pause every few feet to move his ladder down the wall, the official's progress was torturously slow. There was plenty of time to observe the fate of others, to feel their exhilaration and their sorrow, and, as the count approached your own number, to feel your heart accelerate to pounding. I can recapture now with vividness how it felt to be waiting in the early morning light, completely identified with that unfamiliar ritual. What happened there that morning was every bit as important to me as it was to the others. Those moments of belonging, the more so for how rare and far between they were, live in my memory incandescently. My number was 107, and there it was on the scroll in Japanese numbers, Ichimaru Nana. Tears came to my eyes. I had been admitted to the University of Tokyo. So that's, you know, that's a real memory that's undoctored. You know, I mean, I can actually, with confidence, tell you that that happened, as did much of the stuff in this book, most of it, of course. I mean, I'm creating a persona, but I'm not creating that. So tell me how much more time I have.
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. Let me just choose one other something. This might amuse you a bit. I'll go light instead of heavy and then end up slightly heavier. Here's a great thing that would never happen again. And this is a story that I know Amber and others who know about publishing would appreciate. When a personal matter came out in the United States, the incomparable Barney Rossett, who owned Grove Press in those days and was in his heyday, decided that there was only one way to get appropriate attention focused on a novel by an unknown novelist in the West. So he called O.A. here, paid for him, brought him over, and then we went out for 30 days of lunches, in which talking to book reviewers resident in New York. This was a great thing. I mean, can you imagine that happening today? It's very unlikely. In any event, here's a little episode. Late in May 1968, Grove flew O.A. to New York to help promote the book. For 2 weeks, we met with reviewers every day. Our objective was to direct their attention to the slim volume by an unknown Japanese novelist in the stack of unread books on their desks. To amuse ourselves, O.A. and I ordered Eggs Benedict every day at lunch at a different restaurant and compared notes. At the end of 2 weeks, we agreed that Sardi's East served the best. Is Sardi's East still around? I don't know. Soon enough, we developed an effective routine. At a pause in the stilted table talk about forks and chopsticks or the tale of Genji, I would turn the conversation to an American novel, Huckleberry Finn or The Invisible Man or The Adventures of Augie March. This was O.A.'s cue to display his command of American fiction, which, believe me, he had masterfully. It made me proud to watch him perform, speaking in his mispronounced but expressive English. By the end of a lunch or a round of drinks at the Black Circle Bar, critics were so dazzled they couldn't wait to get back to the office to read A Personal Matter. The book received enthusiastic reviews everywhere that mattered, with one exception. Writing from Singapore for the New York Review of Books, the British poet and Asian traveler D.J. Enright, whom we hadn't met, pounced on O.A.'s ending. You remember the end of Personal Matter? It's got this kind of what might be called a sugar sweet, uplifting little coda attached to it, which I won't talk about tonight because anyway, it was a problem. And Enright wrote, "The only thing about A Personal Matter that might be said to be revolutionary is its happy as possible ending. The pity is that this is wholly incongruous. It is simply inconceivable that Bird, the hero, could turn over so many leaves in the space of the book's last few pages. Even the most avid admirers of the happy ending in fiction will find this one a miserable fraud." But Enright's nastiness was chaff in a bracing wind of admiration. Our triumph was Elliot Fremont Smith. I don't know if you guys remember him. He was a very influential and powerful reviewer at the New York Times. When he showed up at lunch, Fremont Smith seemed distracted, as though wondering why he had come at all, and could scarcely be bothered to ask the usual polite questions. Then the conversation turned to opening lines in great novels. O.A. proposed that first sentences were half the battle and engaged Fremont Smith in a debate about what Melville had accomplished with Call Me Ishmael. It was clear when we parted that the Times reviewer was intrigued. The following week, he titled his review in Books of Times, "Two from Japan, A Curiosity and a Discovery." The curiosity was Mishima's Forbidden Colors, a variation on a Miss Havisham theme. The step from Forbidden Colors to A Personal Matter is like emerging from an impossible perfumed hothouse into the clear, real world. Fremont Smith continued, "The book is original, different, tough in its candor, and beautiful in its faithfulness to both intellectual precision and human tenderness. We shall be reading more of O.A., hopefully in as fine a translation as John Nathan here provides. Alone, A Personal Matter is something very close to a perfect contemporary novel." So the point is that this lunch ritual really paid off. Fremont Smith's praise was sweet music to us. I won't pretend that our exhilaration, O.A.'s and mine, wasn't spiced by the fact that Mishima had fared so badly in the same review. Thinking back, I wonder how Mishima felt. Perhaps the review was of small interest. At the time, June 1968, he was at boot camp with his private army of young nationalists, the Shield Society, already on the road, though no one knew it, to a martyr's death by his own hand. Before O.A. left the country, he joined us at East Hampton. This is Barney Rossett had lived in Robert Motherwell's house in East Hampton. It's quite a magnificent place. Barney had brought along a packet of reviews. We read them aloud at the dinner table and toasted A Personal Matter and one another. O.A. got very drunk and proposed other toasts, and we raised our glasses to Mao and Fidel Castro. Barney observed that his two dogs, Suki and Yaki, were looking forlorn, so we toasted them too. That was, these dogs were named, of course, in honor of Mr. O.A., whom Barney was... So in any event, I think I'm coming to the place where we're going to have questions and so on. I'll just say in closing that in connection with this thematic note that I sounded, however faintly, about persona, ending this book was a real problem for me. It's sort of like, what do you leave a reader with, and what are your options? I mean, the story goes on forever, And obviously the last thing is going to set some kind of a tonality. So I did it fully three times. The first time I did it, it felt too close. I was trapped in the present. And the ending had to do with my daughter, Emily, you know, saying to me, you know, you're an old man, Daddy. Why don't you drink tea, behave yourself in the garden like Monet did and not be a kind of a jerk and so on. And I talked about extraordinary mildness and wished that I'd had some and so on and so forth. It was clever and it worked, but it felt not right in terms of this persona. I didn't want to somehow overburden the reader with this kind of an exposure. The next one I wrote about actually feeling more and more disengaged from Japan, but I also included a long episode of Mr. Oe, a very unfortunate moment that had occurred between us a couple of years ago when he didn't see me and I was upset and I wrote him a letter and he didn't answer. And once again, Amber Qureshi in her clairvoyance said, John, you know, don't do that. You know, you might be friends with Oe again, which in fact has happened. So I would have ruined and trashed that relationship if she hadn't intervened on my behalf, which she did, for which I'm grateful. So finally, you know, I threw that part out but retained basically a kind of an honest, actually for me, quite honest really, you know, admission that Japan was meaning somewhat less to me and that I was kind of pursuing roads of my own now that were taking me apart and that I was feeling as though I was going to find a place that was really home, which I think is going to be the Lower East Side actually, and that Japan may or may not, although I'd be excited to be there again, be quite so important to me. So that's just an indication of how in persona and endings, you know, can collide and how a lot of work has to be done in order to make everything work out just right.